It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Stephen Skeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. After a year of intense politicking, the health care overhaul is hanging by a thread in the Senate. Democrats are scrambling to put together the 60 votes they need to push the bill over the finish line. Republicans are trying to run out the clock before the Christmas holiday, though the biggest problem for the Democrats at this point is within their own party. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
The biggest worry for the Democrats remains Ben Nelson of Nebraska. For some time, he's been troubled by the bill's language on abortion. He says it doesn't do enough to ban federal funding of the procedure. But in an interview yesterday with Lincoln, Nebraska radio station KLIN, Nelson said abortion is just the beginning of his problems with the health bill.
If the abortion issue is taken care of to your satisfaction, whether it be some kind of compromise that was to your satisfaction, would that be enough for you to vote for cloture and then
No.
go forward?
No.
That's not enough alone.
That's not enough.
Nelson went on to detail his problems with the bill's expansion of Medicaid and several other more technical provisions. And he didn't seem very optimistic about the chances of his becoming the 60th vote for the bill by Christmas.
I can't tell you that they couldn't come up with something that would be satisfactory on abortion between now and then and solve all the other issues that I've raised to them, but I don't see how.
The next most likely candidate for giving Democrats that critical 60th vote they need to get the bill past Republican objections is a Republican, Maine's Olympia Snow. She voted for the bill when it passed the Senate Finance Committee in October, but last night she didn't sound like she was getting closer to becoming a yes vote either.
My argument has been, why not use January as an opportunity to continue to work through these issues, to build the consensus, and making sure that we proceed in a fashion that's consistent with the United States Senate and institutions, what people rightfully expect of us.
Of course, stretching the debate out beyond the Christmas holidays is exactly what Republicans want, because the longer the bill is on the Senate floor, the more time they have to criticize it. And so far, their criticism seems to be working. Each successive public opinion poll shows support for the entire overhaul effort slipping. A Washington Post ABC poll this week showed a majority of uninsured people thought they would be better off under the status quo than under the changes now being proposed. And Republicans are using every parliamentary tool at their disposal to make the debate last as long as possible, much to the frustration of Democrats like California's Dianne Feinstein.
In 17 years, I've never seen it this way. And I think, you know, people get a sense now of what is a procedural motion to stop a bill. And that's what's going on, to stop, to delay, and to prevent health care from getting done. That's what this is all about.
That means that when Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid finally does get his 60 votes lined up and introduces his final amendment to the bill, Republicans can keep the clock running for nearly a week more if they want to. The best-case scenario at the moment puts a final vote on the bill into the evening of Christmas Eve. The not-so-nice scenario has the Senate in session Christmas Day. Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus said last night he doesn't think it will come to that.
We like a little bit of drama.
But just in case, some senators are making contingency plans. Democrat Patrick Leahy said he's having his Christmas tree shipped down to Washington from Vermont. And Mary Landrieu of Louisiana offered up this possibility.
Well, we're talking about that. We may go to Al Franken's idea for Secret Santa. You know, that was his idea. And we may have to revive that idea.
Of course, this all assumes that Reid can round up all 60 votes, and it's not just moderates holding out. He's given them so much to get their votes that some of his liberals are now threatening to walk away from the bill. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Many communities are not just short on jobs right now. They're also offering a little less civic cheer this holiday season. Tight budgets are forcing cities and towns to scale back their displays and celebrations. From Philadelphia, Joel Rose reports.
At a church rec hall deep in South Philadelphia, the Frelinger String Band is halfway through a four-hour rehearsal. With their baseball hats and hooded sweatshirts, these guys look more like a beer league softball team than a finely tuned musical ensemble until they start playing their instruments. These men are mummers. Every year on New Year's Day, they put on elaborate costumes and parade up Broad Street to downtown Philadelphia where they compete with other clubs to see whose song and dance routine is the best. For the last 110 years, the parade has enjoyed the blessing and, most years, the financial support of city officials. But with Philadelphia facing a budget crisis, the city wants the mummers to pay for police and sanitation.
If they force that type of an issue, it would mean the end of the mummers parade.
Local attorney George Beatty is a member of the Frelinger String Band and the founder of SaveTheMummers.com.
We're different than just a one-day parade. The mummers is a year-long tradition that generates over $9 million for the local economy. So to eradicate that would be not only unfortunate and sad for the city, but it would be economically foolish.
Beatty is optimistic that the mummers and the city will find a way to share the cost of the parade. City officials didn't want to comment, but Philadelphia isn't the only municipality that's struggling to pay for beloved but expensive holiday traditions. For instance, officials in Fresno, California, decided not to bring a six-story Christmas tree down from the Sierra Nevada mountains. Spokesman Randy Reed says it didn't seem appropriate since the city just announced a round of layoffs and employee furloughs.
As we're looking at, you know, making reductions in other areas of the city's operation, we thought a more modest approach was appropriate this year.
Reed says Fresno decided to skip the big lighting ceremony as well, although it does have a smaller tree inside City Hall. The city of Chicago also decided on a more modest approach for the Christmas tree in Daley Plaza.
For the past several years, we've taken 113 smaller trees and made one large tree. So when we went to the one large tree this year, people kind of like scratching their heads.
Megan McDonald directs the mayor's office of special events. And yes, she said 113 trees. Last year, Chicago spent roughly $350,000 on the display. This year, the tree itself was donated, and the whole thing only cost the city $46,000. Though not everyone loves the result.
It's a little thin, but the lights are pretty.
I like it. I think it's very authentic looking, like straight from nature. Looks a little sad. Reminds me of a Charlie Brown tree. Just it looks a little sparse on the bottom.
Tony Harper, Laura Steffen, and Emily Diefenthaler in Chicago's Daley Plaza. Across the country, city officials are hoping their constituents take a hint from the old Charlie Brown TV special and make the most out of modest holiday decorations. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
The point of the climate negotiations is to replace the 1997 Kyoto Climate Treaty. The U.S. never ratified that treaty because it doesn't require rapidly industrializing countries to cut emissions, countries such as China and India. Today, NPR correspondent Richard Harris sat down in Copenhagen with the head of the American negotiating team. Todd Stern said China and India's reluctance to make binding commitments remains a stumbling block.
They have lived in a nice house called Kyoto for quite a number of years, and that house doesn't require them to do anything at all. It imposes obligations on developed countries, but not on them. They're now being asked to move into a different place. But look, there is no way to have a sound environmental treaty unless you do that. China today is the biggest emitter in the world of greenhouse gases. They're going to be 60% bigger than us by 2020, 80% bigger than us by 2030. So we're the biggest emitters historically. We make no bones about that. We're not saying it's all their fault or anything like that. But you can't begin to solve this problem until you have the major developing countries on board.
So what incentives do they have to join?
Well, I think that there is a lot in it for a great many developing countries in terms of the assistance that can be provided in the way of technology to help develop low-carbon economies, in terms of the kind of funding that Secretary Clinton talked about today, particularly for poor countries who have to deal with the effects of climate change, floods and droughts and rising sea level and the like. With respect to countries like China and India, look, I think that they need to be part of an international community of major players where they step up and take responsibilities.
How much of this is really about jockeying for position economically globally?
I don't think it's so much jockeying for position fundamentally, but there is a real jobs and economic development component to this. I think it's terribly important that the United States put the right incentives in place The U.S. is the most innovative country in the world. We need to get our innovators working, develop a whole green tech set of industries, and compete.
Do you think you're going to come out of here with an actual deal?
I hope that we come out of here with an actual deal. It's important that we do. I think that there has been a lot of time lost, and time that we didn't have in these negotiations, with aggravating procedural wrangling, really led by the developing country group. By no means all of them, but enough of them to really tie the process up into knots. We should have been in a place in terms of the negotiating process, at least a couple of days ago, that we didn't get to, we haven't gotten to till now. So I think that people say where there's a will, there's a way, and that's true. It's also true that the opposite, if there's not a will, then there's not going to be a way. And I think we're trying to find out right now whether enough countries are ready to really step up and get this done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was U.S. Climate Envoy Todd Stern speaking with NPR science correspondent Richard Harris in Copenhagen.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The U.S. economy has lost more than 7 million jobs over the last couple of years. Employers, of course, say they routinely get dozens of applications for every job they have to fill. But there's a paradox here. For all the people looking for work, employers still have trouble filling some jobs. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
On any given morning, the research room in the New York Labor Department's job center in Brooklyn is crammed with people looking for work. Today, Eleanor LeBird, who was laid off from her job at a boutique in October, is sitting at a computer doing what she does every morning.
Basically going online every day, trying to look for work.
And when you go online, where do you go? What sites?
Monster, the government labor sites, and also like Snagajob. It's kind of like a full-time job, just trying to find one.
LeBird says she finds plenty of jobs online and applies for one or more every day. And to look at some of the sites she frequents, you might think this was a job hunter's market. The Conference Board regularly looks at online sites to count jobs, eliminating old and redundant postings. And as of a week ago, it had counted 3.4 million job postings online. That's about half the number of jobs lost since this recession began. And many of the companies doing the postings have multiple positions to fill. So the number of available jobs those postings represent is even higher. With so many jobs to fill, why does the unemployment rate remain so high? One obvious reason is what economists call the skills gap. Michelle Choina, who's been unemployed since last spring, says she always finds lots of medical jobs online.
Every hospital has listings for medical assistants or people with employees, potential employees who are able to do EKG, phlebotomy.
I can do that.
Except Choina can't do these jobs because for now she lacks the training. Most applicants do, which is why hospitals need to go online looking for candidates. There's also the issue of geography. Ratin Sinha is president of the job bank America's Job Exchange. He says available jobs aren't dispersed around the country evenly, and he says many jobs don't pay moving expenses. So even if applicants are willing to move to, say, South Dakota, they may not be able to afford it.
Some of these jobs are not really on the high end of the wage, scale. So if somebody has to move, they most likely they have to move on their own.
Sinha says the number of jobs online is misleading in another way. He says right now we're in an employer's market and companies are taking advantage of it.
Given the overall economic condition, I think they are being more prudent, and more selective in their hiring process. They have now, I think, a little bit time and leverage to get a better candidate.
Instead of choosing someone from the applications they receive, they're looking harder, and they often post jobs online to find the right people. There's another important reason the job market may not be as healthy as these websites suggest. The Labor Department says the economy has lost more than 4 million jobs in 2009, but that's a net loss. Ken Goldstein of the Conference Board says, in reality, there's a lot of churn in the economy.
We have a very dynamic labor market all the time. There are always people who are moving into a job, moving out of a job, looking to move out of a job. And it's that friction, the friction between what's available and who's looking for something.
Goldstein says even in a recession like this one, jobs are being created. What the websites don't show is that there are also a lot more people looking for work, people who've been laid off or people who've just graduated from college. And he says it will probably be a long time, maybe even years, before the number of jobs catches up to the number of applicants. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.